Tennessee Williams' The Glass Menagerie has been a theater staple since its Broadway debut in 1945. It tells of the Wingfields' mother Amanda, abandoned by her husband, sucking the oxygen out of the small apartment she shares with son Tom and daughter Laura. Tom, a stand-in for Tennessee, dreams of a writing life. Laura, crippled by an unexplained limp and an overwhelming shyness, fades into the background until a gentleman caller arrives. Maybe you've read the play, performed it in high school, or saw this 1973 television version with Katharine Hepburn as Amanda, turning on her southern charm for the caller she desperately hopes will rescue her daughter.
Well, 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 so this is Mr. O'Connor. Introductions entirely unnecessary. I've heard so much about you from my boy, I finally said to him, Tom, good gracious, why don't you bring this paragon to supper finally?
The Glass Menagerie is about Tennessee Williams' memories, but maybe in yours it's become caricature. Oh, that overbearing Amanda. Well, now comes director John Tiffany's new production at the American Repertory Theater here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, with acclaimed stage actress Cherry Jones as the mother.
I married a man who worked for the telephone company. That gallantly smiling gentleman over there, a telephone man who fell in love with long distance. And now he travels. I don't even know where to.
This Glass Menagerie is different. For one thing, there's just one small crystal unicorn front and center. For another, Amanda makes you weep, not cringe. We sat down with the cast. Over the next few minutes, you'll hear from Cherry Jones, Celia Keenan-Bolger, who plays Laura, and Zachary Quinto, who plays Tom. Later, the gentleman caller, Brian J. Smith. We began by asking Cherry about her Amanda. Maybe it's because many of us are older than when we first saw this play, but she seems so much more sympathetic.
It would have been hard for me to play her any other way because her mission is so difficult and she's so committed to making sure that this child is going to be able to survive after she's gone. And to me, she's incredibly admirable. She maybe is annoying as all get out, but I have great respect for her.
Well, that comes through. There was no social safety net back then. There was nothing. And maybe there's more of a sympathy towards single moms raising families, more of a consciousness about them now, so we see it through a different filter.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they did everything under the sun to feed, clothe, house these children. That was her job as a single mother. And why were they single? In her case, she's abandoned, which is the worst possible scenario. Yes, I think she's something else, and I don't know how she did it. Yeah.
Did you all do this play when you were in high school somewhere? I'm looking at all four. Had you all read it, Celia?
I had read it in high school and didn't respond particularly to it. I didn't, and I'd never seen a production of it.
Really?
Yeah, and which I think actually was a little bit of a blessing because it's intimidating to tackle. The Glass Menagerie. It's a play that is so beloved by so many people. But I do think the minute that we started rehearsing the play, it became apparent that all of the ideas that we had had about this piece could be thrown out the window.
For instance, tell me, what were some of those ideas? I mean, what did one maybe you have?
That you do a literal representation of the Glass Menagerie.
And in your case of your character, there's a cabinet and there's all these glass figures in it?
Exactly. And the truth is, when we started rehearsal, my Glass Menagerie was much larger. And that as we kept working on the piece, we realized Tennessee Williams says in an introduction to the Glass Menagerie, we're trying to get at the emotional truth. And I think John Tiffany's approach was to strip away everything that wasn't needed.
And I think this play is also often underestimated in his canon of work. And I think part of the reason for that is that it doesn't have the edge and the sexual infusion that some of his other plays have. But it's the clearest distillation of his own experience. And I think that's another thing that this production really represents. Everything is distilled down to the absolute minimum that it would need to be so that the Glass Menagerie becomes one single piece of glass. And characters in the play talk about, you know, a tray of lemonade or a bottle of dandelion wine and glasses, and can you carry it all? And in those moments in rehearsal where, you know, it became clear that that wasn't what was important.
To have actually five lemonade glasses and a pitcher is more distracting. The audience hears it, they know it, and they use their imagination, or they don't even have to bother with it because that's not, as you say, important to the memory.
That's Cherry Jones. Before that, Zach Quinto, Celia Keenan-Bolger, of the cast of The Glass Menagerie at the ART here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. When we come back, the gentleman caller comes calling here and now. It's here and now, and we've been visiting with the cast of director John Tiffany's new revival of Tennessee Williams' The Glass Menagerie at the American Rep Theater here in Cambridge and rumored to be on its way to Broadway. If so, it will be on a stunningly minimal set surrounded by an inky pool of water and on the wings of four critically acclaimed performances, including Zachary Quinto's Tom, which the New York Times called the best ever. Tennessee Williams was actually born Tom. Like his character, he lived with his family in an apartment, although his father didn't desert them. He worked at a factory, had a fragile sister, suffocating mother. The play is his memories of that family in a pre-World War II world.
The young couples would come outside to the relative privacy of the alley. You could see them kissing behind ash pits and telephone poles. This was the compensation for lives that passed like mine without any change or adventure. Changes and adventure, however, were imminent this year. They were waiting around the corner for all these dancing kids, suspended in the mist over Berchtes Garden, caught in the folds of Chamberlain's umbrella. In Spain, there was Guernica. Here, there was only hot swing music and liquor and dance halls and bars and movies. And sex that hung in the gloom like a chandelier and flooded the world with brief, deceptive rainbows.
Also in the cast, Cherry Jones as Mother Amanda, Celia Keenan-Bolger as Daughter Laura, and Brian J. Smith as the Gentleman Caller. Now, all the characters seem fuller than the caricatures in our memory. For instance, while Tom says the Gentleman Caller, a former high school star now reduced to working at the factory, is a symbol of hope for Laura, Brian's was more than that.
It's funny, in the Tennessee, in one of the editions, has these character descriptions of all four of the characters, and of course for Amanda and Laura and Tom, he goes on for paragraphs, and then he gets to the Gentleman Caller, and it just says, a nice, ordinary young man. And I think that it's a trap to just take that at face value. I think that we approached it in a way that we were interested in the irony behind that, or Jim's awareness of someone who's just a nice, ordinary young man and the fear of being swallowed up in this world that is going to damn him to oblivion when he thought that he was something that was so special and had so much potential.
I find your Gentleman Caller really complicated. He's got a lot more going on. It's almost as if you want to say to the family, you think you have problems. You know, look what just walked in the door.
Yeah, he said, he's got a very simple line that's actually very poetic and truthful. He says, people are not so dreadful once you get to know them. And he's also saying, when you get to know people, you realize that you're not alone and that someone who might seem to have everything all together is just as, has their own particular struggles and their own sense of loss and their own heartbreak. And I was so grateful that John insisted that the Gentleman Caller wasn't just a device, that he was as real and as present and immediate a presence as the rest of the Wingfields are.
Okay, the dogs. We were briefly interrupted by Zachary Quinto's dogs, which directed the attention back to him. So, Zach, I have to ask, best Tom ever, according to the New York Times. Is when you read that, is that, or maybe you don't read it. But maybe I'm the first to tell you, but
well, I probably wouldn't have read it, but you're definitely not the first to tell me. So that was hard to avoid. It was everything I could do to just forget that those words had been written about me and continue every night to really grapple with my own challenges with the character, which are many and frequent.
What are they? You know,
maintaining an authenticity and to not ever settle, because this is endlessly deep work. I mean, Tennessee Williams was tapping into something that there's no mistake that we're doing his plays 70 years after they were written and first produced.
It's interesting because, I mean, as you say, Tennessee, tremendous depth, and we all want to keep diving down into the aquifer of this production. But it is tricky, because one person can go off in this direction, which changes where you go, which may not be quite where you need to go, or that, you know what I mean?
Where you thought you would go.
So you do.
Can you give me an example of that? I mean, might Zach one night as Tom reduce the seethingness that he has towards you, and then you are like, wait a minute, what am I pushing back against because he's not seething? Is it something like that?
Yeah. It's something as simple as that that would change the temperature.
Or Cherry's Amanda one night can be particularly strident in a way that, you know, informs Tom's relationship to that particular Amanda.
You just made a face like, wait, what are you doing? You know, so you'd have that internally?
Yeah, where there's an attack to her or a defensiveness to her in that particular performance that requires some kind of adjustment or some unconscious or unintentional reaction that gets elicited.
What are you looking at?
The moon.
Is there a moon this evening?
It's rising over Garfinkel's Delicatessen.
Oh, so it is. Such a little silver slip of a moon. Have you made a wish on it?
Mm-hmm.
What'd you wish for?
That's a secret.
Right, and I won't tell you what I wish for either. I can keep a secret, too. I can be just as mysterious as you are.
There was a talk back after the show that I was at, and Brian, you were there. One gentleman in the audience said, I've seen this something like 50 times, and I don't like that you, what is this, inky pool of water, and, you know, where's the glass menagerie? And Laura had her back turned to me at one point. He wanted that traditional staging that we talked about.
Something that I thought was so revealing is he said there were too many tricks. I don't like tricks in the theater. And I felt like saying, well, I mean, the first thing that Tom says is I've got tricks in my pocket. I've got things up my sleeve. I mean, it's so funny how, and I, you know, I'll tell you, I can be guilty of this as an audience member, is going in with expectations and going in with my own production in my mind of how I want it to be, as opposed to having the experience that's in front of me. And I think I think we all struggle with that in our lives, much less, you know, being audience members going to see live theater.
And I will say that at the end of his long list of grievances, he said, but I did enjoy it.
Well, and on the other hand, Cherry, in the same audience, you had Cornel West, a well-known professor. It speaks to the universality of this, because when I said, oh, I just love Glass Menagerie, and someone said to me, are you from the South? And I said, no, but people from New York understand these tensions. And he, a black man, said, I will, if there is a Tennessee Williams or a Stephen Sondheim play within 50 miles of where I am, I don't care if it's a high school production, I go.
I think it's because it's family and it's memory. And especially if you're of a certain age, there is nothing more potent than that. And this is an incredibly cathartic play about family and memory, because it makes you realize that you're not alone with a lot of pain and a lot of loss and a lot of heartache. And you get to do it with a large body of people because it's the theater. It is a very nourishing, almost religious experience. And so perhaps that's why Dr. West liked it too.
Cherry Jones, Brian J. Smith, and Celia Keenan-Bolger, and Zachary Quinto and his dogs. To Zach's many fans, we hope to have him back to talk about his role Spock in the new Star Trek film in May. Meantime, try to remain calm when you go see The Play. The Play, director John Tiffany's production of Tennessee Williams' Glass Menagerie, runs through this Sunday at the American Repertory Theater here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Rumors of a trip to Broadway. And by the way, this is Laura's Waltz. We'll hear more of this tomorrow. It features Grammy-winning violist Kim Kashkashian. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.